Well, I'll tell you, after all the wait, all these years where Sergei Fedorov's number should have been retired here in Hockey Town, they did it last night, and they did it with a bang.
There was a nostalgia to last night, like the really great Red Wings teams of the past. I mean, he rode in this burgundy Corvette. All the players had these white skates that Paul Boyer taped all their skates so it looked like his skates. Mm-hmm. I mean, he came to the podium. He clearly was just honored for this moment.
There it is, Detroit number 91, forever in Hockey Town. Fans, one more time, let's hear it for Sergei Fedorov.
I will remember this night for the rest of my life. Thank you, thank you, thank you. With all my heart, Hockey Town, love you all. Go Wings!
It was really nice. And even in that speech, he was like, Detroit has always been my home. He mentioned that, you know, that's on me. I shouldn't have left. And then he looked back at Steve Yzerman. So, I mean, I just thought it was great.
It was great. It's well-deserved. And I loved that. Yeah, they really literally rolled out the red carpet for him.
They did. And the team did as well. I mean, they blew a 3-goal lead in the third, but they came back to win in overtime. I mean, it was just special.
I was at church with Jake last night. Oh. He's going through catechism right now. Mm-hmm. And I had to be there. A parent had to be there last night, so I was there. And I get an alert on my watch, and it said, the Red Wings scored 91 seconds into the game on the jersey retirement of number 91. Now, I think the official box score says 92 seconds into the game, but still unbelievable. The blowing of the 3-goal lead was troubling, but they came back to win in overtime.
Yeah. Fourth win in a row. Can this team calibrate and become Hockey Town again? Like, maybe.
I do. We do a little segment called Hockey Talk on our Facebook, and I do it with Blaine Fowler over at our sister station, WDVD. Uh-huh. And we talked about, like, are the Red Wings real? Are the Red Wings real? And I just like, yeah, I guess. I mean, I guess they're real. It doesn't look great all the time. But, they're good. They're fun.
They had these late-season collapses most recently, several years in a row. So I'm waiting for them to get through that.
Yeah. Right, yeah, exactly.
President Trump arriving in Detroit today for an unofficial affordability tour. But new data suggests he faces a steep uphill climb with Michigan voters. A fresh poll from the Detroit News and WDIV reveals that 64% of likely voters have seen their household costs climb over the past year, with an overwhelming 82% citing grocery prices as their primary burden. Now, the president is scheduled to tour Ford Factory in Dearborn before addressing the Detroit Econ Club. While he is expected to tout tariffs and tax cuts as a key to a manufacturing renaissance, the poll shows a sharp motivation gap. Democratic voter enthusiasm currently outpaces Republicans by 16 points, with Michigan's generic ballot leaning towards Democrats. Today's visit is a high-stakes attempt to regain footing in a state where twice as many voters currently give the administration's economic performance an F as those who give it an A.
What do you think he's going to say today?
I think he's going to say the same old rally stuff. Mm-hmm. Like he usually does, and that the economy's humming and it's the best place in the world. That's what I think.
I wouldn't be surprised if he talked about this phone call with Elizabeth Warren. Did you see this last night?
I heard about it.
So she gave a speech about affordability.
Yes.
She criticized the president because she feels like his efforts to address the cost of things have not been sufficient enough, and that the American people still feel the pinch. They're still paying too much. And she said, after my speech, the president called me. I delivered the same message on affordability to him directly. I told him that Congress can pass legislation to cap credit card rates if he will actually fight for it. And the White House said that there was a productive speech. It wasn't yelling. It wasn't angry. It wasn't derogatory. It wasn't anything like that. And that she was asked if she would work with him on this issue. And she said, I'll work with anybody that wants to and is serious about lowering the cost for people. So, interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. Could be a little bipartisan effort between him and, you know, somebody that he has.
That he's called different names.
Different names.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the 10% cap on credit cards would be great.
Yes.
That'd be great. The credit card companies are not on board.
No, yeah. They would not
they
be on board.
They would not be happy.
Yeah, the good folks at MasterCard and Visa would not be
no,
pleased.
No.
And he just said it should happen. I'm like, okay, great, let's do it.
Do it, yeah. Do something, please do something.
Give us some relief here.
Please do something.
There's a lot of reaction still from this case against the Fed chair. And it's like, you know, the people you would expect, like Lisa Murkowski, but it's also people you may not expect. So, you know, Republicans and Democrats treading lightly here. Senator Kevin Cramer of North Dakota, critical of Powell, but said he doesn't believe the Fed chair is a criminal. Quote, I hope this criminal investigation can be put to rest quickly along with the remainder of Jerome Powell's term. We need to restore confidence in the Fed. Thune said, I haven't seen the case or whatever the allegation or charges are, but they better be real and they better be serious.
Do you ever watch that Abby Phillips show on CNN where they sit around the table?
Sit around the table and
yell at
each other?
I'm sorry, I don't remember the name of it, but I flipped it on last night.
Uh-huh.
And I was watching and they were talking about this. Again, it's not a great show to gather information. It's just people yelling at each other mostly.
Yeah.
But one of the things that they said is that there have been reports that Donald Trump is not happy with Pam Bondi. That Donald and it seemed to be the consensus amongst the pundits that Donald Trump didn't know about this, that this was not something that he directed, that he had talked about, that this was something that kind of came out of the blue for him. That there was a headline yesterday that said Donald Trump wasn't happy with Pam Bondi mm-hmm. and the job that she's doing. Mm-hmm. And then so yesterday in recent days mm-hmm. and then these charges get brought. So,
well, there's reporting that Jeanine Pirro was behind this. Ask her above up people, supervisors.
So the thought is, are they just doing this to please him? Are they doing this to placate him?
Because he's
but
done.
If he's not aware of it, I don't know how you're placating.
Well, he's done in May, right? I mean, he's
Jerome Powell.
Jerome Powell's done in May. I just, you know, the president hate him so bad that the president wanted to go after him. Now I don't know that, you know, like you said, that maybe these people were trying to please the president, but it seems like to me he could wait it out until May.
Well, the last month talked about bringing charges possibly to Powell. So it's not like out of the blue, but Pirro might have gone rogue on this.
This situation in Iran is becoming a thing, and mm-hmm. it's been a thing. And unfortunately, when you're dealing with these types of protests, things like that, in countries like this, the numbers are never really accurate. You kind of get a range. I mean, I've seen everything from over 500 deaths to 650 deaths of these protesters, these anti-regime protesters. Well, what could happen here? Because I was reading a story in ABC and they talked about the potential ramifications of, let's say, an economy collapse. Well, what happens when the economy collapses? You're going to get people fleeing. You're going to get refugees in other countries. You're going to, I mean, it's going to completely destabilize the country, the region. It's mm-hmm. going to become really mm-hmm. problematic. But if there is a mass killing of civilians, of protesters, Donald Trump says that crosses a line, what type of military action could there be? Well, you've got military experts opining on the idea of, you know, targeted strikes. Targeted strikes on regime outlets that are using whatever they're using to quell the unrest or to attack civilians. Maybe there's a widespread military operation where you've got many different assets mm-hmm. Attacking this regime. So this is something that is going to be considered, I would imagine, here in the next couple of days.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like things are coming to a head. And so a decision has to be made.
Well, and Iran says, listen, if you guys come after us, we're going to hit some of your American bases over here in the Middle East. But then there's other talk that there's been some talk behind the scenes, and Iran doesn't seem so hostile when they're talking behind the scenes with
officials. Donald Trump said that they're willing to talk.
Yeah.
And they are continuing this action. So they're having a hard time deciphering what Iran's all about right now. Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk more about Donald Trump in Detroit today. He's speaking at the Econ Club. It's next on Jared Morning.
What the president and his administration have already done to deliver on both of those fronts. And I think we'll get a taste of what is kind of in store for the American people in the new year here.
Akush, the president had previously referred to affordability jitters as a hoax, but there's a new Detroit News poll that came out today. It shows 82% of Michiganders are seeing their grocery bills spike right now. Is the president's message to those families that their bank statements are wrong? What's his message to them?
Well, no, that's not true. What he didn't call affordability a hoax. What we called a hoax was Democrats starting to harp on this issue when, you know, this is their crisis that they created in the first place. And so for Democrats who spent 4 years abetting the Joe Biden economic disaster, who spent 4 years defending the Joe Biden's economic disaster, to now come out and say, oh, you know, these problems that we're seeing because of Joe Biden's policies that we supported all along are actually a huge problem now and Donald Trump's fault. No, that's what the president is calling a hoax and a joke. Obviously, we fully understand that affordability is a serious concern for the American people. That's why President Trump was elected in the first place. And that's what the president has continued to be focused on, again, since day one. When you look at tax cuts, when you look at deregulation, when you look at the investments that are pouring in, when you look at some of the micro-targeted things like egg prices that the president has done, when you look at gas prices. So this has been a big focus since day one, and it continues to be a big focus. The hoax here is that Democrats are harping on an issue that, again, they created and they gaslit Americans about 4 years.
What about the tariff issue? The president has been very clear about the purpose of the tariffs. But what about, you know, some of these auto suppliers that are spending, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars on tariffs right now and maybe not using it for expansion? What would he say to them?
Sure. I think he'd reply with two things. Number one is that there's also a spate of supply side reforms to help those same auto parts manufacturers to reshore their manufacturing back in the United States. That's deregulation, like the president getting rid of these CAFE standards on cars. It's also things like the big, beautiful bill, the tax cuts we saw, the full equipment expensing, where companies can write off 100% of investments they make in manufacturing and new factories, right? The second point is that, look, we can't, the status quo where foreign countries are ripping us off and undermining our industry and our workers can't stand. And, you know, the president's already taken a very nimble approach to the auto industry in particular. That's why we've seen auto tariff relief actions. But again, this is a long-term process here. We've already seen a spate of new trade deals that expand access for these same American companies in foreign markets. You can now sell an American car in Japan and in Europe, an American-made car, which is something unimaginable just 2 years ago. So this is a process that's playing out. And again, I think the president is very focused on kind of restoring the dominance of the American auto industry at every level of the supply chain.
Yeah, and I think there's still a disparity, though, because the president has said that the economy is moving in the right direction. And yes, he would like to see, you know, interest rates come down even further more quickly. But at the same time, there are still people, our listeners will call us and still tell us that, you know, things are still too expensive. So there is a bit of a disparity between what people are feeling and maybe what the numbers show.
Well, look, those two things aren't mutually exclusive. I think we can say that things are trending in the right direction because they are trending in the right direction. You know, inflation isn't at the 5 to 9% we saw under Joe Biden's presidency. It's cooled to a rate that's roughly half of that. We've seen investments continue to flow in. We're Americans about to see record tax refunds in this coming tax season. And we can, all those things can be true, and we can still acknowledge that there's still a lot of work to be done. And that's exactly what the president has said, you know, during his speech right before Christmas. He said exactly so, that a lot of work remains. And that's what the administration and the president are both very, you know, laser focused on heading into this year.
Speaking with Kush Desai, White House Deputy Press Secretary here on JR Morning. And Kush, back in 2024, the president warned that the whole country would end up like Detroit if he lost. Now he's back here in the city, you know, to court voters. Is Detroit a cautionary tale or the engine of an American comeback?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. Again, I mean, Detroit is sort of ground zero for what happens when you have America's last trade policies and broken, you know, a broken tax code and broken regulations take over and strangle American industry and American manufacturing and American growth. And I think the president is focused on turning the page on that and doing a bit of a U-turn to get back to, you know, this sort of golden era for American manufacturing. And that's especially true for cities like Detroit. Again, it could have been a cautionary tale, but I think we're seeing a resurgence in, with these trillions of dollars in manufacturing flowing in, thanks to the president's policies, a resurgence in cities like Detroit across the Midwest.
Does he have time to stop at the auto show today?
You know what? I'll check with the schedule and see him and get back to you, see if he can fit that in there.
Why was it important for him to go to this manufacturing facility for Ford?
Sure. Well, look, number one, Michigan came out big numbers for the president, and I think the president is deeply appreciative of that. But number two, I think, again, you know, this the American auto industry is this it's this keystone industry, this gem of American of the American economy, and you know, restoring the dominance of the American auto industry has been a very key focus for the president. That's why there have been so many tailored deregulatory and trade actions that are specifically focused on the auto industry, more so than really any other industry, even more so than steel and aluminum, for instance. And so the president coming back to Detroit, I think, is his way of saying, look, you know, you had my back, and I still, you know, continue to have your back. You know, we are going to write the next American golden age, the next chapter in our American golden age together. And me and my administration are going to continue to do whatever we need to do to get you back on track.
Well, it's exciting that the president's coming to town. If you want to just drop him a line, you have our number. He can give us a call this morning if he wants. You know, just getting up, and we'll be happy to take his call.
I'll send him a text right now.
There
okay.
you go.
Appreciate it.
Coach Desai, always appreciate you making yourself available to us. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Take care.
Yeah, you got it. Look, anytime a president's in town, it's a good thing. It's
Absolutely.
Exciting. And he's going to be speaking to the Detroit Economic Club this afternoon.
He loves the Detroit Economic Club.
He does.
He does.
He goes and talks to them frequently.
Yes, he does.
Yeah, this is what, his third
appearance? Yeah, because 2016 and 2024.
And he was here.
And you know how they love timing at the Detroit Economic Club?
They really
do. He does not go with their timing.
No, it just kind of goes with the flow.
I mean, that's what you're going to get when you're the president, right? It's not like you're going
to,
you know, plan this 6 months out.
And I was talking to a lot of people who work downtown.
Yeah.
You know, work there. Like, yeah, I'm going to work from home today because, yeah. you know, yeah. traffic is going to be crazy.
Sure.
We'll shut down freeways
Absolutely.
And stuff with the motorcade. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I mean, look, it's how it's got to be.
Yeah.
It's how it's got to be.
Well, cars are getting smarter by the day. Loaded with sensors and a lot of software. Of course, AI is part of it as well. But the roads, though, they travel on, well, not so much. But that's starting to change. Across the country, you got a lot of technology is being embedded into roadways to improve traffic flow and enhance safety and give cities real-time data about what's happening on the streets. I know there's a street right outside of
New Lab.
It's
called Electrion.
Yeah, and it's I think it's 14th Street, as a matter of fact, if I'm not mistaken, that is a smart road. So, you know, a lot of this is happening across the country. We're even getting it here in the city.
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, we've talked about it a lot over at New Lab about what's going on there. And so apparently other companies are doing this too.
Well, and it's just time for that to change. We have the smart cars. Now we need some smart roads. It's the subject of our Mobility Makers. It's brought to you by Bridgestone. Getting people down the road matters, but getting generations down them, that's what really matters. Bridgestone. Visit whatreallymatters.com to learn more. Leading that push is Recor Systems. And joining us now is Charlie Deglielmini. He is Executive Vice President at Recor Systems. Charlie, good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So cars are getting smarter every year, but most of our roads, they still operate like, 1985 or something. What's the disconnect? And why does that gap matter right now?
You're exactly right. So if you think about it, we see way more driverless cars in our cities. We see Tesla's now launching its own fleet of driverless cars. We're driving vehicles now that are communicating. They're very, very smart, but our roadways are analog. They're dumb, right? So that needs to change. We need to have our roadways become as smart as our vehicles.
Well, when people hear smart roads, they sometimes picture maybe like a science fiction highway or something. And plain English, what actually makes a road smart?
So it's the technology that human beings actually can use to identify movement, behavior, direction, things that are happening on the roadway. For example, if you've ever seen a traffic management center, you see a bunch of screens, you see a lot of human beings looking at those screens, trying to figure out, is there an accident on this particular roadway? What AI does, what our company does, is we provide AI inside of those traffic management centers to make the traffic center operators almost superhuman. The AI says, stop, look, listen, there's something going on right here.
So how does it work practically? Does it tell you where the traffic is? Does it give you a different route? Tell me how it works.
It's all of the above, right? So there is public facing information, and we're on a trajectory now where you could expect your car entertainment system to receive a warning. There's a fire truck ahead. Be careful, right? That's months, if not weeks ahead of us. We're going to start seeing that very, very, very soon. But the practicality is the AI is able to get help to where there's an accident, where there's traffic building, quicker than even a 911 call can happen, right? Because it's seeing things. We're pulling in things like Bluetooth data, Waze data, video data. We're pulling in weather data, right? It combines up all of that information and says, look, there's problems here. They need to be addressed.
So then what's the capabilities of expanding this technology? I mean, I can't imagine we're going to make all of our roads smart roads in the blink of an eye. So what's the path forward for this technology?
The path forward is state by state. States like Michigan, that you're working very, very hard on this. You have a very, very advanced DOT. Other states are doing the same. Texas gave our company, Recore Systems, a blanket order for the entire state, right? So we're seeing more and more states, usually through the departments of transportation, taking a good hard look at this technology.
And for drivers, Charlie, who are worried about privacy, you know, what's important for them to kind of understand about how roadway AI works and what it doesn't do?
Right. So it is not looking. The only thing that's personally identifying information when you're driving your car is your license plate. And someone can look up your license plate hypothetically, mm-hmm. and figure out who the registered owner, not necessarily the driver, but who the registered owner might be. Everything we're talking about this morning doesn't use any license plate information. So your privacy is protected.
And, you know, you said you have a contract now with Texas. City invests in smart road technology, I mean, how quickly are the residents there expected to see some real noticeable improvements?
It doesn't take long. The whole onboarding for this technology is a matter of weeks, perhaps a month or two. And, you know, once a city or a state decides to do this, the implementation time doesn't take that long.
Charlie Deglielmini, Executive Vice President, Recore Systems. We appreciate you coming on, giving us this great information. Boy, the future looks bright.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
You as well. Smart cars, smart roads.
Hey, while you're in there putting this technology in, if you could just put in some heating elements too, so we could just...
not deal with the snow and ice and stuff like that?
You know, you got like the heated bathroom floor.
Uh-huh.
If you could just throw some of those in too, that'd be nice.
I think the cost might be too much for that whole plan, but I like where your head's at.
I don't know. I'm not the money's guy. I'm just the ideas guy.
Yeah,
well, you just do it in sections, you know? You do a little bit at
That's
a
right.
time.
And, That's right. Know,
And,
That's right.
And
start with our driveway, then do our streets,
right.
And go to our route to work. We'll start there.
I mean, I think it's a great application for artificial intelligence. I mean, if you are able to manage traffic better, if you're able to reduce the amount of accidents, if you're able to alert drivers ahead of time that there is something in right. front of them, then I think that's all well and good. It feels like it's a big undertaking.
It is.
It would be a big undertaking. And you're relying on people with high technology filled vehicles, where not everybody's quite there yet.
Exactly. And, you know, I'm wondering if these roads, you know, we have the smart cars that can help you supposedly avoid crashes. And one of these smart roads can contribute to that as well. Have less accidents on the road. Who knows?
Well, if it can tell you that there's a stopped vehicle a mile mm-hmm. up, maybe so.
Maybe yeah. so. Coming up, the president is in town today, and he's going to be at the Econ Club this afternoon. He's also going to tour a Ford plant in Dearborn. And could this also help the midterms? We'll talk to Jason Rowe, political communication strategist at Rowe Strategic, coming up next on JR Morning.
Welcome back to JR Morning. The president is coming today. He's going to tour a manufacturing plant, a Ford manufacturing plant, and talk to the Detroit Economic Club. What's in this visit? Why now? Why here in Michigan? Let's ask Jason Rowe, political and communication strategist at Rowe Strategic. Hey, Jason, how are you?
Good morning. Great. Thanks.
This comes at a time when the off elections didn't go well for Republicans. And there's this poll in the news that Michigan voters are soured on the economy. Does all that play a role into coming to Michigan today?
Yeah, I don't think it's an accident that Michigan is the target for the speech. The centerpiece of his economic plan has been tariffs, and there's probably no country or no state in the country that is more acutely affected by tariff policy than Michigan, given our relationship with Canada, but also the auto industry and the manufacturing that happens here in the state. So I think it was a choice made because of how important Michigan is. And not to be lost on it is the importance of this state politically, with an open U.S. Senate seat, three competitive congressional seats, as well as an open governor's race. Michigan's going to be the center of the political universe. So I think this is definitely an opportunity, and I think a good environment for him to talk about what he's going to do to address the affordability issues that people are wrestling with, but also highlight what he believes to be the successes of his tariff program.
So, as you said, Michigan has been a focal point in election battles before. And so should the voters here expect it to be ground zero again in 2026?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, there's not a state in the country that's got more on the board. I think you're going to see more than $1 billion in combined spending for races in Michigan, which is just a jaw-dropping amount of money. For President Trump, his main priority is control of Congress. And so you have, obviously, the U.S. Senate seat, which would – Michigan represents the best opportunity to flip a Democrat seat to a Republican seat with Mike Rogers. But you've got Congressman Tom Barrett, a first-term congressman that flipped a Democratic seat, who will probably be one of the top three targets in the country. You've got the John James open seat over in Macomb County in Rochester, which, you know, that'll be a top five seat in the country. You have the Flint-based district, Michigan's 8th district, with Kristen McDonald-Rivett. There's not a top-tier Republican in that race, but that is a seat that President Trump won. And so when it comes to control of the House and the Senate, Michigan probably provides more opportunity and more risk than any state in the country.
I mean, the problem, and I hear you, I completely agree that Michigan makes the most sense in wanting to spend a little bit of time in spotlighting Michigan, but he's had a mixed bag on, you know, supporting and throwing his name into the mix as it being a net positive.
Well, that's true. When you look at endorsements, you know, he's lost three times at convention, which is the most MAGA crowd of Republicans in the state. He has, you know, maybe won 50% of the races, competitive races, that he's endorsed in a primary. So his, you know, imprimatur is not necessarily the gold standard for candidates. But there is a lot at stake, and I think there has been a consensus that he needs to engage and sell his economic policies, but he also needs to rally the base. And, you know, one thing that came through in the Detroit News WDIV poll, and something we certainly took away from the off-year elections of a couple months ago, is that the intensity of the Trump haters is much more intense than the Trump supporters. And so, you know, take the polling that just came out. When you look at likely voters, his numbers are pretty consistent with where they've always been when it comes to favorability. But when you get to those, very, very likely voters, he drops significantly. And I think when you see some of the polling that's going to come out in the U.S. Senate race and the governor's race in the coming days, I've got a little preview of it. You will see that intensity affects those races as well. And so he's got to, one, turn the corner on the economy, and he did inherit a mess. And I will give the administration credit. You know, they projected that the benefits of the tariff policies would happen in Q1 of 2025. And we did see a pretty remarkable 4.2% GDP number. We saw a cooling of inflation of 2.7%, down to 2.7%. And at 8:30 this morning, we're going to get new inflation numbers to see if last month was an anomaly or the beginning of a trend. And then in a couple months, you've got the Trump tax cuts that people are going to start realizing that they don't owe as much as taxes. They're going to get refunds. I was just texting with a friend yesterday who did his initial taxes, and he said he's paying half as much as he paid last year for, I would say, you know, a middle income salary. And so, you know, there's some signs there, and there's some injection in household income that could help accelerate an economic turnaround. I don't know that that's going to address inflation, because the tariffs, frankly, a lot of the costs of the tariffs were built in to inventory for last year. And so you're going to start seeing manufacturers pass the cost of tariffs on to consumers this year. So that's going to affect the affordability issue. But there are some signs that, you know, we're turning the corner, but it's too early to tell. And I do think that inflation is going to kind of be dogged. And I don't just mean the CPI number. I mean what the cost of things is, like healthcare, like groceries, like some of the staples that all of us rely on.
Jason, when the president comes to a city like Detroit, what should voters be listening for? What he says on stage or what he's doing behind the scenes? I mean, the last time he was here in 24, he said if he lost that, you know, the whole country could turn out like Detroit. I don't think he meant it in a nice way.
You know, Ron Ziegler, who was the press secretary for President Nixon, once famously said to a reporter, don't report on what he says, report on what he means. One thing we have learned from Trump is not to take him literally. So it almost doesn't even matter what he says, because he's the kind of guy that just throws, you know, spaghetti at the wall, sees what sticks. But I also think part of his style is to keep everybody guessing what's real. But in terms of your question, what should people be looking for is, what is the administration going to do about affordability issues? And there's not a ton you can do between now and an election. So a lot of it's going to be what's already baked into the policies that he has implemented. But you've seen some very populist issues that he's grabbed onto. The idea of a 50-year mortgage, which is, by the way, ridiculous, and I don't think is going to happen. Capping credit card APR rates at 10% for a year, which also is not very good economic policy. One thing that he brought up in the last week, and something that I think you can see some bipartisan consensus and is a real and good policy, that even Elizabeth Warren, a very progressive senator from Massachusetts, has advocated.
Yeah, we talked about that earlier. It's an unlikely partnership.
It is certainly one, and I watched her do an interview yesterday on national news, and she failed to mention that her and the president were in alignment. But that issue is getting private equity out of the housing ownership market.
Right.
I mean,
that would be
affordability crisis, and this is a contributing factor.
Thank you, Jason Rowe. We're out of time. We appreciate it. Coming up, Detroit Legends Unite for Fedorov.
All right, Donald Trump in town today, 91, officially where it should be, hanging up in the banners at Little Caesars Arena. What a night it was last night down at the rink.
Very nostalgic. Like, it just brought you back to a very good time in Red Wings hockey. Sergei Fedorov's 91, heads up to the rafters, and he says that when he played here, and he went to a lot of other places, and he said it was, you know, I shouldn't have left, that it was the best playing in front of Wings fans.
You pushed us when we need energy, and on the big nights, the jaw shook. You don't forget that the noise, the emotions, the connections. I'll say it again, there is nothing like playing in front of you. Nothing.
True.
Wow.
True that. Preach. Preach, Sergey.
And the Joe did rock. I miss the Joe.
Miss the Joe. Look, I love LCA. It's a beautiful facility. Mm-hmm. I miss the Joe. I miss the Joe because it was grimy. It was ours.
All of that.
It was not a great
all of that
facility.
No.
It was a concrete box.
Yeah.
But all the things that happened there, you just can't take that away.
There was a moment with Konstantinov. Mm-hmm. There was a moment with Sergei Fedorov. It just like felt so good to be back with all of those people again.
Yes.
And then the current team won on this night in overtime. It's all very exciting.
It was very exciting. And I love that they were able to do this again. Like, I hate giving flowers after the fact.
I know.
I hate giving flowers when it's too late.
Yep.
So I love that they finally did this. It's wonderful. Meanwhile, Donald Trump's in town today. What do you think of that?
Yeah, he is. He'll be at the Econ Club today, and he's going to tour a factory in Dearborn, a Ford factory in Dearborn. And so a lot riding, though, on Michigan, because a lot going on here as far as politically. A lot of open seats, and you got a governor's race ongoing. I mean, you got a lot of things happening here. So I think he wants to be here to talk to the voters of Michigan and Detroit about what's going to be happening in these midterms as well.
I mean, you can not like his immigration policies or what he's doing on immigration.
Yeah.
The people coming across the border are basically zero at this point. Mm-hmm. So that's something he talked about. He also talked about affordability. He also talked about making things more affordable. And so, you know, has enough been done? We'll see, right? I guess if the taxes come back and it's vastly different for people, maybe that makes a difference, maybe that sways their opinion. But there's still a lot of work that needs to be done on the affordability front. The Democrats have tried to take that message and make it their own, while Donald Trump is saying that there has been work done, it will only get better. He talked about the economy booming this year. Well, the midterms are coming up in this calendar year, and so he's got work to do if he wants to make up some of that ground that I think has been lost.
Versus a new poll, the Detroit News Channel 4 poll, WDIV, saying that 64% of likely voters have seen their household costs climb over the past year, with an overwhelming 82% citing grocery prices as their primary burden. And that's here in the state of Michigan. So it's still an issue here.
He obviously knows that affordability is a thing, because he starts talking about other things like this 10% cap on credit card rates. That sounds good. I mean, I don't know how real it is. Our credit card company is going to get behind this, but that could make a difference for folks.
It's apparently something that he and Elizabeth Warren are going to talk about.
Yeah.
Doing together.
Had a little chat.
Unlikely bedfellows.
Yeah.
Donald Trump and Elizabeth Warren.
I know.
She gave a speech yesterday and talked about affordability. Donald Trump called her up, and she basically reiterated all of her talking points from the speech, and was asked if, you know, she would work with him on this. And she said yes. And one of those issues was capping credit cards at 10%.
If it happens, would be great. Will it happen? I don't know. When it comes to what's going on in Minnesota, the Minnesota and Twin Cities are suing the federal government to stop the surge of ICE troops to the area. Another 1,000 federal agents are expected to deploy to Minneapolis after everything that happened there with Renee Good. I was listening to a legal analyst yesterday, and they were saying this is really for show. They don't see any legal basis here that this could work.
This lawsuit.
Right.
Right. Right. But again, they've got to do something.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you've got a bunch of people there that are very unhappy. They have been protesting. They've been doing all of these things. That's kind of what I took away from it, too. Not ceremonial, but it's a step to show that they're trying to push back against this.
Right. And, you know, a judge is going to have to make some decisions here, but it may not be constitutional.
And then everything happening in Iran is very scary. I mean, I know that your daughter is overseas, and that certainly is a concern, but it's getting very hairy over there.
It is.
There has been hundreds and hundreds of deaths linked to these protests, these counter-regime protests. And Donald Trump is going to have to consider whether the United States is going to get involved in this. Because, you know, he's talked about stability in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And you got to give him credit. There has been a lot of work done in this first year on that. Yeah. And there has been a little bit of leveling out for what amount of time, we don't know, right? Because now all of this is blowing up in Iran. But this could be kind of that first domino to fall, that, you know, there is destabilization, at least in the region.
It may fall on its own, because right now they're really in a bad way.
Well, if you think more than 500 protesters have been killed and 11,000 arrested, I mean, 11,000 people arrested by this regime, and then Starlink, they're looking for people who have these Starlink, you know, who are broadcasting these protests.
It's banned in Iran, Starlink.
Clearly, the protesters see this as a moment, maybe, because Iran is weakened right now. We'll see.
Oof. A lot happening.
A lot happening.
Always, all the time, every day.
What's that movie that won an Oscar? Everything, Everywhere, All at Once, or something like that?
Right.
It's kind of how it feels. 7:12, time for WJR's Business Beat, brought to you by Shelving.com. We rack your world. Here's Jeff Sloan, the founder and CEO of Startup Nation, and spotlight the entrepreneurial tech and startup community on WJR.
Good morning. One of the top audio formats today is, of course, podcasting. Whether you are a creator doing a podcast as your business, or whether you are a business that uses the podcast medium to establish expertise, create awareness, and build consumer confidence that leads to sales, podcasts are a powerful tool to get it done. And 2026 stands to be a year filled with lots of change when it comes to podcasts. That, according to Deloitte's 2026 Technology, Media, and Telecommunications Outlook Report. The report says this about the power of podcasts. As podcasts rapidly gain traction with global audiences, the brands and platforms that embrace the medium's immersive, shareable format stand to benefit from deeper engagement, stronger communities, and expanded monetization opportunities. The biggest change to the podcasting sector, according to the report, that's the move from pure audio content to podcasts using the video format. Deloitte forecasts that an increasing share of popular podcasts will offer video, and that consumers will gravitate toward platforms that support robust video experiences. That because, among other things, vodcast watchers, as podcasts are called when they're in the video format, also display higher engagement, as 44% say they never multitask while watching, compared to 29% of audio-only podcast listeners. And that suggests more focused attention on video content. Deloitte data also shows video podcast consumers tend to consume 1.5 times more content than those who only listen. And about 25% of U.S. listeners and watchers report purchasing products or services they hear about on podcasts, indicating strong ad-driven commerce potential. The bottom line, whether video or audio, the collective global annual ad revenue from podcasts and vodcasts will hit approximately $5 billion in 2026. That's a near 20% jump from last year. Podcasts are hot. Make them work for your business. I'm Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of StartupNation.com. And that's today's business beat on the great voice of the Great Lakes, WJR.
Well, the president is here later on today because he wants to talk about affordability. And there's a new poll from the Detroit News and WDIV that says 64% of respondents said their household costs have gone up in the past year. And 82.5% of those individuals pointed to food and groceries. I can't talk today. Richard Zuba is the founder of the Lansing-based Glengariff Group. Hello, Richard.
Hey, good morning.
Groceries. It's again on the agenda here. It costs a lot for people to go grocery shopping, and that could affect polling numbers.
Well, it sure could. You know, and you mentioned the 64% saying their household goods have increased, and 82% of those people said it was food and groceries. But we asked specifically about groceries and food prices. And 80% of Michiganders overall said their food prices have gone up in the last year, and 63% of them said it's gone up a lot. So this is really the epicenter of concern voters have right now of what they're paying more for.
I know, Richard, you noted that the president is currently making the same mistake that Joe Biden did in 24, telling voters that they're wrong about prices. Why is it so tempting for administrations to call these concerns a hoax rather than really, you know, acknowledging the pain?
Well, that's a really good question, and I wish I had an answer for it. But I, you know, what I said was nobody wins by telling the voters they're wrong. And Joe Biden 2 years ago did his darndest to try and convince voters the economy was fine. And the numbers we were seeing at the time were the voters were saying inflation is through the roof. And, you know, we see something similar happening now where it's being called a hoax. Everything's fine. Well, guess what? Voters absolutely have a problem with food prices. And I want to point out one number in particular, and that is how independent voters view this. Because in Michigan, independents make all the decisions. 85% of independent voters say their food prices have gone up in the past year, with 67% of them saying it's gone up a lot. Mm. Those are the people who are going to make the decisions and swing elections in the next year.
How do these numbers compare with, say, maybe one of your final polls before the election, because Donald Trump did have an edge over former President Joe Biden in the handling of the economy, where people thought he was going to take this. How do those numbers compare to what you're seeing now?
Well, Joe Biden's numbers in 2024 on the economy were actually much worse than what we're seeing with Donald Trump's numbers. But the difference was Democratic voters in 2024 had turned on Joe Biden. What we're seeing this year is these Republican voters absolutely are still with Donald Trump. But it's the independent and Democratic voters who really have turned on Donald Trump on the economy. And, you know, as I keep saying it, I keep harping on it, but it's that middle, the 18% of voters who are hardcore independents, who really make all the decisions here. Republicans go with the Republican candidate, Democrats go with the Democratic candidate, and that 18% in the middle, how they feel is essential because you have to win them over.
And per your poll, the survey finding that it's Trump's economic policies that they blame for these prices.
Well, we asked the question, has Donald Trump's economic policies made the economy weaker, stronger, or have they had no impact? 48% of voters said it's made the economy weaker. 38% said stronger, and 10% said no impact. So right off the bat, you're looking at, you know, President Trump's policies underwater by 10 points with Michigan voters. And, you know, we have to pay attention to that as we look to the November election, because it's going to have ramifications. Now, there's plenty of time yet to change those perceptions. There's plenty of time to, you know, have an argument, to present a plan to the voters that they become confident with. But that's not where they're at right now.
Richard, the president is going to be at a Ford factory today. He's going to be touting tariffs. But your poll shows that most voters give him a D or an F on the economy. Are the tariffs being viewed as a shield for Michigan jobs or just another tax on Michigan consumers?
You know, we do all the polling for the Detroit Regional Chamber, and they've done extensive public polling on tariffs. And what we found over the course of this last year, starting when the tariffs went into effect, is Michigan voters overwhelmingly, whether they support the tariffs or not, think tariffs raise costs. They are the ones paying for those costs. It's not even close. Even Donald Trump supporters said tariffs will raise costs. And so there is a feeling amongst Michigan voters that that is contributing to the increases in costs of what they're paying. And, you know, there's a split with Republicans, most Republicans still supporting tariffs, but Democrats and independents really do not. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing that coalition form on these economic questions with Democrats and those key independent voters.
It's all about the economy. Richard Szuba with the poll talking with us this morning. Thank you.
You're welcome.
There was this Wall Street Journal podcast with a Livonia manufacturer, Chuck Dardis of Alpha USA, and he talked about tariffs. And he said he paid $1 million on tariffs on nuts imported from Taiwan and that it kept him from spending on capital expansion. So that's the real life experience of one person in our state.
800-859-0957, 800-859-0WJR. What's your perspective on the economy? What's your perspective on the bills that you're paying? Are you paying too much still? And do you think that not enough has been done? Because I think there are people that feel that way. I think there are Trump supporters even feel like not enough has been done.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, there are still a huge faction of his base is with him, like Richard Szuba said.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going anywhere. And they're willing, I think, in some instances, to wait a little longer for that economic relief to kick in to finally go, yeah, see, his policies were the right way to go. But it does take time. These politicians talk about, I'm going to do this on day one, and I'm going to do this. And it's just not real. It's not reality.
Yeah,
it's fantasy.
Yeah, because you don't know what's really going on until you get in there. You just don't know.
Well, also, there are a lot of factors. If he could flip a switch and make groceries cheaper, he
sure.
would.
Oh, yeah.
But there are many, many factors when it comes to all of this. And it's, you know, there's a level of how much you're paying at the grocery store, and then who do you blame for how much you're paying? Like, I think about it every single time I go to the grocery store. I had, like, four bags, and it was, like, $200.
Yeah.
And it wasn't even, like, meat or alcohol.
Right.
It was, like, staples.
Right.
Milk.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So
I'm just trying the hardest.
Yeah.
Just out here grinding.
Yeah. That's it.
Yeah. So, all right, let's move on here on JR Morning. And we are going to talk to someone within the administration on the plans for the president and what he might talk about today in Michigan.
So the president's in town today. He's going to be at the Detroit Economic Club. He's also going to tour a manufacturing plant in Dearborn where they make the F-150. So he's going to get a little bit of the taste of the automotive side of the Motor City when he comes to town. Let's bring in Kush Desai. He's a White House Deputy Press Secretary who joins us this morning. Kush, it's good to have you back.
Thanks for having me on again.
So the president's coming to town. What can we expect to hear from him today?
Sure. I think, restoring the American dream, American prosperity has been a day one priority for President Trump. As it's turning the page on Joe Biden's affordability, economic disaster here. And I think you'll hear a lot about what the president and his administration have already done to deliver on both of those fronts. And I think you'll get a taste of what is kind of in store for the American people in the next the new year here.
Kush, the president had previously referred to affordability jitters as a hoax, but there's a new Detroit News poll that came out today. It shows 82% of Michiganders are seeing their grocery bills spike right now. Is the president's message to those families that their bank statements are wrong? What's his message to them?
Well, no, that's not true. What he didn't call affordability a hoax. What we called a hoax was Democrats starting to harp on this issue when, you know, this is their crisis that they created in the first place. And so for Democrats who spent 4 years abetting the Joe Biden economic disaster, who spent 4 years defending the Joe Biden's economic disaster, to now come out and say, oh, you know, these problems that we're seeing because of Joe Biden's policies that we supported all along are actually a huge problem now and Donald Trump's fault. No, that's what the president is calling a hoax and a joke. Obviously, we fully understand that affordability is a serious concern for the American people. That's why President Trump was elected in the first place. And that's what the president has continued to be focused on, again, since day one. When you look at tax cuts, when you look at deregulation, when you look at the investments that are pouring in, when you look at some of the micro-targeted things like egg prices that the president has done, when you look at gas prices. So this has been a big focus since day one, and it continues to be a big focus. The hoax here is that Democrats are harping on an issue that, again, they created and they gaslit Americans about 4 years.
What about the tariff issue? The president has been very clear about the purpose of the tariffs, but what about, you know, some of these auto suppliers that are spending, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars on tariffs right now and maybe not using it for expansion? What would he say to that?
Sure. I think he'd reply with two things. Number one is that there's also a spate of supply side reforms to help those same auto parts manufacturers to reshore their manufacturing back in the United States. That's deregulation, like the president getting rid of these CAFE standards on cars. It's also things like the Big Beautiful Bill, the tax cuts we saw, the full equipment expensing, where companies can write off 100% of investments they make in manufacturing and new factories, right? The second point is that, look, we can't, the status quo where foreign countries are ripping us off and undermining our industry and our workers can't stand. And you know, the president's already taken a very nimble approach to the auto industry in particular. That's why we've seen auto tariff relief actions. But again, this is a long-term process here. We've already seen a spate of new trade deals that expand access for these same American companies in foreign markets. You can now sell an American car in Japan and in Europe, an American-made car, which is something unimaginable just 2 years ago. So this is a process that's playing out. And again, I think the president is very focused on kind of restoring the dominance of the American auto industry at every level of the supply chain.
Yeah, and I think there's still a disparity, though, because the president has said that the economy is moving in the right direction. And yes, he would like to see, you know, interest rates come down even further more quickly. But at the same time, there are still people, our listeners will call us and still tell us that, you know, things are still too expensive. So there is a bit of a disparity between what people are feeling and maybe what the numbers show.
Well, look, those two things aren't mutually exclusive. I think we can say that things are trending in the right direction because they are trending in the right direction. You know, inflation isn't at the 5 to 9% we saw under Joe Biden's presidency. It's cooled to a rate that's roughly half of that. We've seen investments continue to flow in. where Americans are about to see record tax refunds in this coming tax season. And we can, all those things can be true, and we can still acknowledge that there's still a lot of work to be done. And that's mm-hmm. exactly what the president has said, you know, during his speech right before Christmas. He said exactly so, that a lot of work remains. And that's what the administration and the president are both very, you know, laser focused on heading into this year.
Speaking with Kush Desai, White House Deputy Press Secretary, here on JR Morning. And Kush, back in 2024, the president warned that the whole country will end up like Detroit if he lost. Now he's back here in the city, you know, to court voters. Is Detroit a cautionary tale or the engine of an American comeback?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. Again, I mean, Detroit is sort of ground zero for what happens when you have America's last trade policies and broken, a broken tax code and broken regulations take over and strangle American industry and American manufacturing and American growth. And I think the president is focused on turning the page on that and doing a bit of a U-turn to get back to, this sort of golden era for American manufacturing. And that's especially true for cities like Detroit. It could have been a cautionary tale, but I think we're increasingly seeing a resurgence in, with these trillions of dollars in manufacturing flowing in, thanks to the president's policies, a resurgence in cities like Detroit across the Midwest.
Does he have time to stop at the auto show today?
I'll check with the schedule and see him and get back to you and see if he can fit that in there.
Why was it important for him to go to this manufacturing facility for Ford?
Sure. Well, look, number one, Michigan came out big numbers for the president, and I think the president is deeply appreciative of that. But number two, I think, again, you know, this the American auto industry is this it's this keystone industry, this gem of American of the American economy. And, you know, restoring the dominance of the American auto industry has been a very key focus for the president. That's why there have been so many tailored deregulatory and trade actions that are specifically focused on the auto industry. More so than really any other industry, even more so than steel and aluminum, for instance. And so the president coming back to Detroit, I think, is his way of saying, look, you know, you had my back and I still, you know, continue to have your back. You know, we are going to write the next American golden age, the next chapter in our American golden age together. And me and my administration are going to continue to do whatever we need to do to get you back on track.
Well, it's exciting that the president's coming to town. If you want to just drop him a line, you have our number. He can give us a call this morning if he wants. You know, just getting up and we'll be happy to take his call.
I'll send him a text right now.
There
okay.
you go.
Appreciate it,
Kush Desai. Always appreciate you making yourself available to us. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Take care.
Yeah, you got it. Look, anytime a president's in town, it's a good thing. It's
Absolutely.
Exciting. And he's going to be speaking to the Detroit Economic Club this afternoon.
He loves the Detroit Economic Club.
He does.
He does.
He goes and talks to them frequently.
Yes, he does.
Yeah, this is what, his third
appearance? Yeah, because 2016 and 2024.
And he was here.
And you know how
the
they
election.
Love timing at the Detroit Economic Club?
They really
he
do.
He does not go with their timing.
No, it just kind of goes with the flow.
I mean, that's what you're going to get when you're the president, right? It's not like you're going to, you know, plan this 6 months out.
And I always talk to a lot of people who work downtown.
Yeah.
You know, work there, like, yeah, I'm going to work from home today because, yeah. you know, traffic is going to be crazy.
Sure.
We'll shut down freeways
Absolutely.
And stuff with the motorcade. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's how it's got to be.
Yeah.
It's how it's got to be. You know, also coming up next, we're going to talk about, you remember when J.D. Vance came out after the incident with Renee Good and said, you know, the media is getting it all wrong. Well, there's a piece I read yesterday. Are they learning any lessons from any of this? We'll examine what the national media is role in all of this as the midterms are this year. That's coming up with Jeffrey McCall. He's a communications professor. We'll talk to him next on JR Morning. So came across an interesting piece in The Hill about news outlets and these legacy news stations like ABC, NBC, places like that. And it grabbed me by the headline. Will the obvious established media finally learn its lessons in 2026? A Marist poll towards the end of last year showed that America's trust in media is around 28%, which is a stunning number,
mm-hmm.
a stunning number. And then you look at some of the things that have happened recently, like a YouTuber went to Minnesota and broke open this story about fraud, which now the mayor of Minneapolis says is real and it's something that they need to grapple with. So there is a distrust in the media. Feels like people feel like they're not getting the best information. They're getting slanted or biased information. And as a result, how do they factor into what is going to be a consequential midterm election? Jeffrey McCall is a professor of communications at DePauw University and joins us this morning. Professor, it's good to have you.
Thank you very much.
What prompted you to write this? Was it that Marist number that showed the trust in the institutional media has just deteriorated?
Well, there are a number of polls out in the last couple of years that show about this declining credibility in the media. And this has been going on for a while now. I mean, I think that maybe a lot of us are thinking, hey, this just started a year or two ago, or maybe when Trump first became president, when he became a media basher. But this decline in media credibility has been underway for 20 to 25 years, and it seems to be accelerating. And one of the things we found here is that people who don't trust the media, the establishment media, as I like to call them, will not absorb that messaging anymore. They will not go to those places. So what we've seen happen is the people who don't trust the media, don't have any confidence in it, are not going to believe it or absorb that information. They're going to go to other places. And the other places, you know, could be podcasters. Some of those would be productive and helpful. But they're going to a lot of places on social media. They're going to listen to some guy at the end of the bar. They're not getting reliable information. And honestly, another problem is that a number of news consumers actually stop consuming news. So we have a number of citizens who, since they can't trust the established sources anymore, become what we call news bystanders, which means they don't absorb news anymore and they'd rather be just out in the cold than to try to follow the news. There are consequences for that. We have an uninformed citizenry then, and we have people who go to the polls to exercise their right to vote, but they're not necessarily well informed on the issues.
Right. So they're not able to get any of this information anywhere.
Yeah. They would rather be out in the cold. They would rather be uninformed than to try to sit through media content or media narratives that they think are biased. Or are talking down to them. And I think that's one of the problems with the establishment media is that they become activism kinds of organizations. They believe in advocacy, and the public is speaking back to them. And you talked about the polls, the Marist polls. There are other ones from Gallup and Rasmussen reports and places like that, which shows that the news media has turned, or excuse me, the citizenry has turned on the news media, and you know, they don't trust them anymore. And so therefore, they're going to go to other places or bag out of the news industry altogether and be uninformed. And none of that is very good for a country that is self-governing. And we want the citizens to make decisions at the polls.
Professor, the president routinely attacks the press and he sues news organizations, and some outlets have settled rather than fight. But what message does that send about the media's confidence in itself?
Well, that's a great point. You know, the president routinely bashes the media organizations, and they, when they get sued, they want to settle outside of court rather than to go ahead and fight on First Amendment grounds. And that's a point I make in the column, is that on First Amendment grounds, these media organizations are on pretty solid footing. And we have a Supreme Court in place, which has been very friendly to First Amendment issues and very friendly to the news organizations. And so I would be surprised if these got pushed very far down the court system, that the news organizations would not prevail on First Amendment grounds. And, you know, there was a big flap in the election about the editing at 60 Minutes of the Kamala Harris interview. Mm-hmm. Well, 60 Minutes has every right to edit that thing however they want to. And when CBS settled for that, I thought, well, they're just basically caving into the pressure that is coming from the White House. And not to say that Trump didn't have some concerns to be raised, but not in a legal sense or not in a First Amendment sense, because the First Amendment is very broad in protecting reporters' rights. And I think news organizations need to step up, defend the First Amendment. But I also think they need to be more transparent to let the public and the news consumers know on what basis they're making editorial decisions and journalistic judgments. And I think the news organizations really need to try to listen to the audience out there and say, we're going to provide these people information and facts, and we're not going to try to talk down to them or provide narratives or advocacy because the public is speaking, but the news industry is not listening very well.
I'm going to quote you from your piece here. It says, it is safe to say most parents won't be encouraging sons and daughters into a career path with less prestige than a used car salesman. Take a little umbrage to that. I went to the Medill School of Journalism, and I think there's value in learning the craft of journalism, something these podcasters do not have.
Well, you make a really great point, and I don't want to disparage all the people in the news industry. Certainly, this is not a baby with the bathwater kind of thing. News industry people, many of them are very dedicated. But on the other hand, journalism schools have drifted themselves in recent years, where we now have courses, you know, where we talk about creative nonfiction, for example. There are courses like that in journalism schools. And I'm thinking, you know, if you're talking about nonfiction, it's not creative. It needs to be fact-based. And, you know, the enrollments in journalism schools are in decline. There are fewer young people who are interested in going into journalism, which is a noble profession. But I think it's safe to say that what used to be a more noble profession, and I think in this day and age, we need to have bright young people, but they might not all necessarily come from journalism schools. And I think that's one of the points I'm trying to make here is that we might want to get somebody who's a history major or a philosophy major or something like that,
sure.
And that we get people with a broad range of perspectives who are not coming from journalism schools. And I would also say to the journalism schools, by the way, I did my graduate work at the University of Missouri, Columbia, where they have a very prominent journalism mm-hmm. school, as you know. And I think the journalism schools themselves need to do some introspection to try to figure out, are we preparing people in the best way?
Sure. So that when they get into those positions, they can ask the right questions of our elected leaders. Interesting article, Jeffrey McCall. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate it. 8 o'clock hour coming up. It's JR Morning. All right, 8 o'clock hour. Make sure you're listening at 8:49. We've got Chris Stapleton tickets for you. He's coming to Ford Field August 8th.
Yay!
And we'll give you an opportunity to win those tickets. They're not even on sale yet.
No.
But we've got an opportunity
awesome.
For you to win the tickets. I haven't played that song yet that you guys think I'll know. So I gotta tune
you
that up during
it.
The break.
Yeah, you'll know it.
But, I mean, he's got Lainey Wilson with him. And Alan Stone. So, yeah, it's going to be a banger mm-hmm. of a show. And those Ford Field shows are awesome.
Always.
Awesome. It's a great venue for a show. Meanwhile, Donald Trump's in town today. He is going to be speaking at the Detroit Economic Club. He'll be touring a Ford F-150 plant while he's here. Mm-hmm. It doesn't sound like he's going to make it to the auto show, but very
you know,
cool that the president's in town.
Who knows? You know how
he
does. You know, he
can pivot.
Really on time.
He
yeah.
can pivot.
He's like,
sure.
I got to go try these Coneys. I got to see who, I got to go see who wins.
You never know.
You never know. You never know. Could you
we
imagine?
We have really good McDonald's here if he wants a Big Mac.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great McDonald's here.
Mm-hmm. The one on the boulevard is nice.
Is it?
Yeah. That's a nice one.
Okay. Well, good.
Okay.
I'm just saying.
So that's cool that he's coming into
yeah.
town. That's great. Meanwhile, last night was very exciting. Sergei Fedorov's jersey, his number 91, up in the rafters, officially retired as a Red Wing.
Yeah, I mean, I just found it just so nostalgic talking about, like, the heyday of the Red Wings all winning all these Stanley Cups, the Russian Five. And he, you know, he made it a point to talk to and for Vladdy. I thought that was nice. Mm-hmm. He talked about Steve Yzerman. He said, I'm telling you, you have a great GM here. It's going to happen. I promise you. And he talked about the fans, too, about how when he lands in Detroit, he feels like it's coming home.
You pushed us when we need energy. And on the big nights, the jaw shook. You don't forget that the noise, the emotions, the connections. I'll say it again. There is nothing like playing in front of you. Nothing.
There was nothing like watching him either.
He meant that.
And I like the little elements that the burgundy Corvette he rode mm-hmm. out onto the ice. All the players had white on their skates, which was like so him.
The Nike ice skates.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought like all of these details from the Red Wings was really special, I thought.
It was funny like perusing X last night as all of this was going on. Yes, I was sitting in church, with Jake for his catechism class.
Oh,
but
man.
You had to check.
I was keeping an eye on things, you know. And it's like people forget how dominant he was. And like people are like, he was the best all-around player ever. Like this guy was that. He was that good. Was he the best defenseman? No. Was he Bobby Orr or Nick Lidstrom? No. But overall, like as a total package, size, speed, agility, ability to shoot the puck, pass the puck, he was everything.
He was like the pizzazz to Steve Yzerman's like grit.
Yeah.
And, you know, Todd McClellan had all the Red Wings there watching the entire thing. And the Hurricanes head coach did the same thing,
yeah,
which I thought was a nice little bit of respect.
But it's something that's long and long overdue. So I'm glad that it's finally happened and they showed him the proper respect that he deserves.
Detroit has approved a new ordinance requiring hotels and lodging establishments to display anti-human trafficking signage aimed at giving victims a visible way to seek help. Now, city officials say the timing is critical as visitors arrive for the Detroit Auto Show, a period when trafficking risk can increase. Councilmember Angela Whitfield Calloway says even one trafficking victim is too many, calling the signs potential lifelines. Detroit Police Chief Todd Bettison urging the public to trust their instincts and report suspicious activity, emphasizing it's better to call and be wrong than to stay silent. The police department and community partners like Covenant House say they are stepping up education and outreach during the auto show. Mary Sheffield, our new mayor, says Detroit has zero tolerance for human trafficking and wants survivors to know help is available. And anyone who suspects trafficking or needs help can call 888-373-7888, or you can text Be Free to 233-733.
We talked to a city official, you and I did. I don't know if Chris was here yet. Do you remember that?
About putting these signs in the hotel.
And I believe at the time I said something like, will a sign stop someone if they're already doing this? And I believe it was a woman, I forget who, but she was like, well, at least brings attention to it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it doesn't hurt.
No, to have that information there.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's great to have this there. And this, I mean,
and you may not want to check in there if you're doing some trafficking and you see signs all over the place to say, hey, you know, we're not for this and here's a number.
I would think that would be inferred, but once again, if the sign helps.
Okay. I mean, the other part, too, is once you have big events, right, like the Super Bowl is always talked about as big, you know, human trafficking events.
Mm-hmm.
These events, unfortunately, the reality is this happens when you've got big events in big cities, things like that. So the due diligence, I'm all for it.
Yeah,
I'm all for it, trying to keep these people safe.
I got one for you.
Okay.
House Republicans, including the GOP leaders, are lining up behind a stock trading crackdown. They think this is the moment. Representative Brian Stile from Wisconsin is chairman of the Committee on House Administration, took the lead on drafting a bill that would prevent House and Senate lawmakers from buying additional individual stocks.
Can you play the Golden Gate sounder? The sound of the angels when you reach the pearly gates. Could you play that sounder for me? That's not it, but I love it. Sign it today.
Oh.
Making money off of being in Congress. Bad.
Yeah.
We all agreed that that's
100%
true.
No.
Making money off being in Congress when you have information
and
that other people
don't have.
And you sit on a military committee and weirdly the United States signs a new military contract with a company that just was in front of you. Weird how that works out.
Yeah.
Oh, you just bought $500,000? Oh, crazy how that works.
No, just lucky.
No, stop it.
In 2012, they passed the Stock Act, mandating more disclosures and outlawing trading on non-public information, what you're talking about. But they've struggled to crack down on it. Like, there's no teeth to it.
Yeah, that's the problem.
Yeah.
It's the problem. Because again, talking in real world terms, how can somebody making $170,000 a year in 3 years be worth $7 million?
Oh.
How does that make any sense? Again, I ain't no math expert, but that math ain't mathin'.
No.
So something's going on where all of a sudden you're valued at millions of dollars. So I don't like it. I think it is an incentive to get to Congress and not do work. It's an incentive to get there
and get rich.
To line your pockets.
Yeah, get rich. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm.
sign that bill today.
They're drafting it. They're drafting it. The lawmakers couldn't make new purchases on individual stocks, but they'd still be allowed to buy and sell investment funds that are diversified.
Clear their books. I don't want any of it.
And there are penalties if you don't follow the rules under this.
Great.
Longer
right to jail. I don't know. Whatever it is.
that Parks and Rec.
Perp walk.
Right to jail.
Perp walk.
You buy stock when you're in Congress? Right to jail. I don't want any of it. Again, it incentivizes you not to do your job because you take your eye off the ball.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't like any of it. I think that would change the game. It would change the people that are willing to go and do the work. It would change a lot of things.
More work gets done?
I would think so.
Mm-hmm.
Because then you have people there that are actually interested in public service and not running under the guise of public service.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sign that bill yesterday. Meanwhile, somebody running for Secretary of State on the Republican side of things saying that there was a review and there were citizenship issues on voter rolls of those who were sitting or potentially sitting on juries. We'll talk to Anthony Ferlini next in JR Morning. So officials in Macomb County are reviewing state data systems after it was discovered that there were non-citizens included in recent jury pools. And in some cases, there was, according to Anthony Ferlini, there appeared to be voter registration records on some of these folks. 239 non-citizens in jury pools over a four-month period. And Anthony Ferlini is running for Secretary of State. He's the clerk in Macomb County, and he's drawing attention to this and joins us this morning. Anthony, it's good to have you.
Good morning. Good morning.
How did you come across this, that there were 239 non-citizens in these jury pools over a quarter?
Well, this has been pretty routine, and it wasn't until we sat in a manager's meeting and we were talking about the amount of bureaucracy that's going on with these jurors and how many are being dismissed and the reason they're being dismissed, and they said non-citizens. I go, non-citizens? How did they get in that pool to begin with? Why would that even be the case? Well, I started thinking about it, and I says, wait a minute, if they're on this list, are they on our other list, which is our election database? And sure as can be, we had 239 over the last 4 months that were non-citizen self-reporting out of the jury duty. We took that list of 239, placed it against the election database, found 14 people were registered to vote at some point in time, which is a crazy number when you think about it, because this is a small sampling. And of that, three of these non-citizens had a voter history. And, you know, we talk about the case in Ann Arbor where this one person voted that was a non-citizen, and everyone made a big deal about it, as they should. But this is bigger, because now this represents a much larger, potentially much larger amount of people that are out there potentially voting or voting across the state that are not citizens. And that's why people are so upset. People are so upset, and that's why this initiative that's going around the state has so much traction, because Americans want to retain that for themselves. Americans voting, citizens-only voting is a critical thing that we're trying to establish. And when you look at this, that 5% of those non-citizens in the jury pool ended up on our QVF. And of that number, 21% voted. And that's a sampling. And it could be better or worse as you go across the state. And the reason I think it's probably worse is because there's a certain amount of people out there that have not reported at all for jury service.
Mm-hmm.
Are those people not saying, hey, listen, I'm not a citizen. I'm not going there. I don't have to go there. And so they don't report to us because it's self-reporting. There is nothing in the state system. If you fill out an application to register to vote, it asks you right up front, are you a U.S. citizen? Well, you know, there's language barriers. There's issues that people might have that, well, yeah, I live in Clinton Township.
Sure. And you're saying this is only from a pool of 239.
Right.
And Anthony, this to me raises a big legal question, too. So what happens to past court cases that have included non-citizens on juries?
I worry about that. I worry about that. But it's self-reporting. We would never have known had we put somebody on the jury pool if they did not self-report. Maybe they're afraid to. Maybe they don't want to admit to it. Now, who knows? Maybe they don't understand it. and they go through the whole system. Maybe they want to serve on a jury. They want to be a juror. They want to be part of the American system, where some people want to get out of it. There's others that want to get in, right? And so they have served. I mean, this is shocking to both myself and Chief Judge Biernat. When I talked to him over the weekend with this, he goes, "Holy cow, this could have ramifications." Now, that number is probably very minute, mm-hmm. but you know, I mean, if I was an attorney that lost a case, I'd want to take a look at that jury pool and make sure that they were all citizens.
Right.
You talked about this initiative. Is this just happening in Macomb County, this looking into reports like this, or is it statewide?
Well, let me just say this. This is something I stumbled upon as the clerk. I have various offices, and this, to the best of my knowledge, I'm the first one to actually put these two type of databases together and applied them against each other and came up with this. So it's something unique that is able to prove, if we're looking for, first off, these 239 never should have been on this database. Why would they have ever been? We don't have 18-year-olds or people, 17-year-olds coming in for jury duty, because we know that they're age, they're below the age of serving on a jury. But we have 239 over this period of time that were non-citizens, and they self-reported.
So then, have you brought this up to Jocelyn Benson's office, or if you're elected Secretary of State, how high on the ladder then of importance does this climb for you?
Oh, it goes right to the top. It goes right to the top because you look at the application for the Michigan voter registration application. All that you have to do is check off, yes, I'm a U.S. citizen, and check off another box that says, I don't have a valid Michigan-issued driver's license or a Michigan-issued state ID or a Social Security number. Check that off. You're in.
So would you change how voter registration is worked here in this state and remove self-reporting?
I believe you need to. I believe that the state of Michigan should check every application for citizenship, and there should be a national database. I know President Trump has asked for it, that a national database where states can check against that database to make sure that this person is a citizen. And it's such a simple thing. It's such a fundamental thing that we need to do that's not happening. And it's unconscionable to me that it's that simple to fill out a voter registration and be somebody that you check it off and you're in.
Yeah.
And of course, there's punishment, but how many people have been punished for this? When you look at the numbers that we have, how many people have been punished?
Well, keep us up to date as you look more into this. I think this is something of interest, and we'll talk again soon. Anthony Forlini, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Again, I think it's a valid question. If you find this data, you see it in front of you, and then you juxtapose it with other information, I think it's fair to ask those questions.
I mean, the Secretary of State, Michigan uses the Secretary of State database, driver's license database, to generate these jury pools and stuff. I'm mm-hmm. wondering how come the system doesn't flag the citizenship part of it. Is that something that can be changed? I mean, with technology now and AI.
I thought the courts used voter lists to come up with juries.
No, well, my information says Michigan uses Secretary of State driver's license database to generate jury pools.
Well, let's ask Garland Gilchrist what they do.
That's right.
Yeah, and we're going to talk to him coming up at 8:35. But again, I think this is part of the reason why people have questions around these elections. Not only elections, but now into the jury pools.
Yeah, well, Get ready for AI and all that stuff being involved. Technology is going
sure.
to get all in here now.
Okay.
Because these things have to.
I mean, again, 239 known. People, small sample size, down to 14 that are on, two different sets of data.
Yeah.
Okay, that's fine. So it is a small sample size. And it's probably not an exorbitant amount of people. But again, to his point, if you're a lawyer and you lose a case
exactly
on something like this, or one way or the other, it doesn't go your way, that is problematic.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think it's worthy to look into some more. Meanwhile, the Lieutenant Governor Garland Gilchrist joins us on the other side. He's going to talk about his decision to drop out of the gubernatorial race and throw his hat into the Secretary of State's race. It certainly changes the landscape.
It does.
Of things here as we get closer to November. We'll talk to him next on JR Morning.
Well, Michigan's race for statewide office took a surprise turn this week. Lieutenant Governor Garland Gilchrist II announced he's ending his run for governor and shifting gears, launching a campaign for Secretary of State instead, a move that reshapes the political landscape around elections, voting, and state government oversight. And joining us now is the Lieutenant Governor Garland Gilchrist, candidate for Michigan Secretary of State. Lieutenant Governor, good morning.
Good morning, everybody. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. You surprised a lot of people by ending your campaign and pivoting to the Secretary of State. What was going through your mind when you made that decision?
You know, I'm proud of the campaign that we ran, and I appreciate the conversations I have with people in Michigan, not only over the last 7 years as Lieutenant Governor, but also over the last years as a candidate for governor. And what there's this remarkable consistency where people were, on the one hand, really talking about and tired of and complaining about how expensive everything is and healthcare and childcare not being available enough and the problems need to be solved there. But they also told me, they said, you know what, if this threat that Donald Trump represents to our democratic process, our norms, the threats to the Voting Rights Act, like if we can't vote and trust it and have that work, then that means we can't vote in people who are going to hold corporations accountable, who are going to fix the systems that are broken, who are going to make housing more available and affordable. Like if that system doesn't work, the rest of these systems cannot be fixed. And it actually had me called back to the first time I entered public life, which was as a candidate for Detroit City Clerk in 2017. Making that system work has never been far from my heart. And so upon reflection on those conversations, I decided that this was the place for me to render the most effective service to fix the system that needs to be fixed and protected in a way that I feel I'm uniquely qualified to do, and that's why I made this change.
Lieutenant Governor, some people out there, critics might say, oh, you're just trying to get into office any way you can, and that's how they see it. Tell them that they're wrong.
They are. No one pressured me to make this decision, and frankly, this is about rendering service, and I think, again, it goes back to the first time I entered into public life. It was to do a function that's very similar to this, to be the election administrator for the city of Detroit, something that was informed by my own voting experience in Detroit, and something that frankly harkens back to some of the unique challenges that are facing our voting system in America right now. I mean, just last year, the Voting Rights Act that protected the voting rights of people like my grandparents who came up from Central Alabama, escaping Jim Crow in search of opportunity and found it in Detroit, but also wanted to be able to vote safely, like that could be gutted. Finally and fatally this year when that decision comes out. And we need real protection from that for voters in the state of Michigan and frankly in this country. And so I'm stepping up to solve that problem.
When did it become apparent to you that you needed to pivot the campaign?
I don't think about it that way. What became apparent upon reflection was that this was the best place for me to render my service. And so I made the decision right before the holidays, and I'm excited to have announced it yesterday.
And, you know, the Democratic field, Lieutenant Governor for Secretary of State, is crowded. How do you plan to distinguish yourself from the other candidates, Barb Byram and Adam Hollier and Suzanne Shirelli?
Yeah, I offer something that's pretty different. You know, I think about some of the unique things about the Secretary of State's office, like the fact that it has more personal data and information about Michiganders than any other state department. And the fact that that data is just like a gold mine potentially for these tech companies that want to mine that data, and frankly has been a target of lawsuits from the Trump administration to try to surveil that data and information. I think Michiganders appreciate their privacy and want somebody who's going to protect it in the Secretary of State's office, and I'm uniquely qualified to do it because, you know, I'm a tech guy. I come from the software industry. I know how to go toe-to-toe with these companies and win because I understand them and they can't lie to me. And so I think I'm uniquely positioned to play that role. I've made systems work for people, and there are a lot of systems in the Secretary of State's office that have to work well for people that need to be modernized and made more convenient and faster, and I'm uniquely able to do that and have shown that I can do it in my role as Lieutenant Governor and even the role that I played in the city of Detroit when I worked in city government. So I think I bring a lot of skills to the table that are just fundamentally different than the other candidates seeking this office, and that's the argument I'm going to make to delegates of the Democratic Convention.
Could you use tech in new ways in the Secretary of State's office? We just had a discussion with someone else running for Secretary of State, Anthony Forlini, who says non-citizens have made it to juries and on the QVF. Is there a way to use tech to ensure everyone feels comfortable?
There's a way to use tech to make a lot of things more convenient. Most people, when they think about the Secretary of State's office, they don't think about elections. They think about licensing and registration. They think about IDs and the fact that, like, you know, look, I think that Michigan should be among the states where people have their IDs available on their phone, because, you know, I know a lot of people lose IDs, fewer people lose their cell phone. And so I think that, you know, for example, bringing that into the 21st century and other services, that is a really important opportunity. And that's what I do. And that's what I build. And I'd love to do that as Secretary of State.
Well, I will say, I mean, you go to the Secretary of State's office and it is much more efficient and streamlined than it used to be.
It's great.
Yeah, it is. So how do you evaluate Jocelyn Benson's job as Secretary of State? And then how do you improve upon that?
I think there's been a lot of progress made, you know, by the secretary and by the professionals in the department. You know, it's a big agency of people in every county and multiple locations that are doing good work on the front lines of customer service. And so I want to build on that momentum. We also want to address some of the things that have significant challenges these last several years. You know, I know as journalists, y'all care a lot about things like campaign finance, you know, what's happening transparently, who's spending money in our elections and how. The website where people are supposed to search that had significant challenges. Well, I know a thing or two about making technology work for people and making systems work for people. That's something that I can fix, because I think for people to have confidence in their leaders, they should know where their money's coming from. That should be really easy to access.
What would be your first action, Lieutenant Governor, that you would take as Secretary of State to show that you're serious about protecting elections and modernizing Michigan systems?
You know, one of the things I'm really excited about, we have people who've been working on our elections for a long time, both in the Secretary of State's office directly, but also people who you see when you go to vote. And I'm going to have conversations with them all over Michigan and be encouraging more people to be able to participate in that process, that we can give those people who've been on the front lines of that, frankly, a chance to be able to train up the new generation. So I'm excited to you know, engage those folks. But I'm also going to make really clear that a priority for me will be increasing voter participation. I'm tired of Michigan being proud of mediocre voter turnout. And so I'm going to engage people from all different generations and backgrounds in a conversation about their power to set the future of Michigan and set its direction by participating in this process, and that we need them in that. That's a big difference between Democrats and Republicans, where, you know, really focused on who can't vote and who shouldn't vote. And I'm focused on what it takes to get Michiganders who are eligible to make sure they participate in an easy and convenient way.
Lieutenant Governor Garland Gilchrist II, candidate for Michigan's Secretary of State now. Thank you so much for being here. Always a pleasure speaking with you, my brother.
Thanks, y'all. Happy 2026. Look forward to talking to y'all again soon.
Happy New Year.
I do have a little bit of breaking news. The inflation number is out, 2.7%, held steady from the report last year, 2.6% when you strip out the volatiles, the food and the energy prices. So not much of a movement there. And that then will probably cause the Fed to hold steady. That's what generally happens. If you've got a steady report, they cut a few times towards the end of the year, and now that number's out, and it's unchanged from last month.
The pace of inflation held steady. So there's still inflation, but the
pace. Yes.
And consumer prices up 2.7 year over year.
So still trying to beat it down to 2%. That's the goal.
All right. Can we get there?
Sure.
I mean,
hopefully,
if anyone knew that answer, they would be betting.
Yeah, I'd be in. I'd have.
You'd be like the
Congress
people.
I'd have Jerome Powell's job.
Yeah. I'd be like the Congress people. Coming up, number 91. His jersey retired yesterday with the Red Wings, and we're going to talk to the radio voice of the Red Wings, Ken Cal, next at 8:49 on JR Morning.
All right, it is 8:49. We've got a pair of Chris Stapleton tickets for y'all. All you got to do is be caller number 9.
Yay!
800-859-0957. 800-859-0WJR.
I want to win this. I'm not eligible.
Coming August 8th at Ford Field. It's going to be a good show. Here's what I do know about Chris Stapleton. Great guitarist.
Yes.
Excellent guitarist. And as somebody who plays very bad guitar, I appreciate when somebody plays good guitar.
You don't know this song.
I don't.
I don't know.
Wow.
It either.
I don't.
But I appreciate Chris Stapleton.
This is the only one by him I knew.
And here's the good thing, is that there are people that are real Chris Stapleton fans, and we're going to send you to the show.
Absolutely.
So, caller number 9, 800-859-0957-760-WJR. Welcoming Chris Stapleton's All-American Roadshow 2026, the Ford Field, Saturday, August 8th, with special guests Lainey Wilson and Alan Stone. Caller number 9. Official rules are at WJR.com. Tickets are available to purchase at 10 a.m. on Friday. So you get a little pre-sale January 16th at Ticketmaster. So that's cool.
Switching gears to a very special night at LCA.
There it is, Detroit number 91 forever in Hockey Town. Fans, one more time, let's hear it for Sergei Fedorov.
Woo! Yeah! Woo! 91 forever!
Yeah!
Yeah! Let's go!
A lot of fans just like Chris, very excited to see 91 up in the rafters. Ken Cow, radio voice of the Detroit Red Wings, joins us now. Hey, Ken.
Oh, working on getting them. There. Working on them.
All right. Well, I retract my head.
Working on getting Kenny Cow.
Oh, man.
For me, when he left, it was heartbreak.
Yeah.
Heartbreak. And then, of course, you go through that, like, when you go through a bad breakup, you're like, fine, I don't want you here anyway. You're not that good. Like, I don't, whatever. I don't, who cares? Bye. Enjoy Anaheim. Uh-huh. Like, you know, but then you're like, boy, I love Sergei Fedorov and I miss him and I want him back. But that's like this the kind of player he was.
Exactly like when I was super excited when Jaromír Jágr was finally retired in Pittsburgh because we had that breakup.
Yes.
Just like Fedorov here.
He was a little bit more of a journeyman, Jaromír Jágr.
Yes.
He bounced around.
Yes. And it was a similar situation. I went to that game as a growing up as a Penguins fan, like so excited to see him again. He actually came out for warm-ups. Fedorov could have done that. He looked great last night.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, totally. But it was like, it was almost like it's the aura. It's part of this unbelievable story of assembling, you know, a line of Russian players, which wasn't the case back then.
The way they got him.
Right.
Like slipping keys under doors and getting him away from the team. And oh my gosh.
Yeah. And so you pair that with his history of the Russian Five. And then it's like, this guy was unbelievable. He had swag. He was just, I mean, he was like the skates that he wore are iconic. Mm-hmm. And they replicated those for the players last night that they wore during the game. So it's like, you have this dude who's got this aura around him, and he's an excellent hockey player.
He was a hockey player's hockey player.
Yeah, but not really. I mean, he was like commercial. Like he became like the face of like Nike for hockey, and like he was a commercial guy, but he was just.
But he could play though.
Yeah, he could play. He was unbelievable.
The Flash.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was the Flash when Yzerman was the gritty, you know, captain. This guy was the Flash who could skate around anyone, and it's just fun to think about those times, to watch all of the highlights of him as this 91 Rafters celebration got closer and closer, reliving that. It harkened back to a really awesome time in Detroit Red Wings history, and it was really Hockey Town then.
It really
we got to get back to that fire for hockey in this town. And this team is 1-4 in a row.
Yep.
You can get back in the playoffs. You could start to get back there.
Yeah, and they're a good team. And Tom McClellan is the coach that they needed, it seems like.
Mm-hmm.
So they're playing a different brand of hockey. You know, last night they blew a 3-goal lead, but they come back to win that thing. And so, you know, it was a good night at LCA.
Ken Cal has joined the conversation. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning, Jamie. How's everything?
Good. How was the celebration last night, the ceremony, the vibes inside LCA?
I thought it was one of the best ceremonies ever. I thought Sergei's speech was outstanding, and just thanking everybody, and I think everybody enjoyed it. It was a wonderful night and long overdue, in my opinion.
You know, he talked about feeling at ease every time he landed in Detroit. How unique is that connection for a player to have a city feel like home, even after leaving?
Well, you know, it was, overall a strange situation, really, when you think about it. It was kind of like a spy novel when he came over to Detroit, defected out of Russia, and then he built his career up here in Detroit and became a superstar at a young age and was a big part of all the Red Wing championship clubs. And, you know, it was just, for him to call Detroit his home, and he admitted that, you know, he messed up at an early age when he left Detroit. He should have stayed. I thought the people liked that because he was honest about his opinion. And, you know, he was an outstanding player for many, many years in Detroit, and was really – one of the better players, best players in the National Hockey League, too, and he could do it all. And I always said this, he's one of the only players, or very few players, that could actually bring fans out of their seat when he would rush the puck out of his zone, and you just knew something good was going to happen. Just a dynamic player, great skater, and a great two-way player as well.
Well, and this seems to be the culmination of what fans have wanted for a long time, too.
Well, right, and again, long overdue. I mean, when Steve Yzerman, you know, he had his number raised to the rafters, Nick Lidstrom, it came rather quickly. And, you know, it just took a while for, you know, Sergei to have his number retired. But I think the Red Wings fans just wanted this to happen for many, many years. And, you know, Sergei was living in Russia. He was coaching there and, you know, played a little hockey there too as well. And, you know, it was time. It was time for him to be honored. And it was really a great ceremony. I really thought it was outstanding.
Yeah, I think the little details that they put into it, like even this Paul Boyer putting tape on all the current Red Wings skates to make them look like Sergei's, was cute.
Yeah, that took a long time. He was talking about that on the plane, how it took 3 or 4 hours for the guys to do all that. I like the fact that the Red Wings came out for warmups and they all wore the number 91 yeah. jersey. And one of the gifts, I guess, that Sergei got was a pair of those white skates again, which was outstanding. And you know what I really liked, too, is they had all the details. You're right. He came to Detroit. One of the first things he wanted was a Corvette. And Mr. Illich said, go ahead, get yourself a Corvette. And what does he do? He comes in on the ice with a Corvette, a red Corvette. So I
Burgundy.
Thought all the details.
Burgundy Corvette. Okay.
Well, it kind of matched the Red Wing uniform.
Yeah,
so, yeah that's
it.
True.
Pretty mm-hmm. good.
Well, I think it's fantastic. I think we should talk further in the future, Ken Cowell, about this current team and if they can get back to the greatness of those times with the Russian Five. So we'll have you again.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks, Jamie.
One of the
awesome.
Best in the business.
Yeah.
Ken Cowell.
Yeah, he's great. Cool.
Yes.
Yeah. He's iconic calls. But yeah, it was a great night. Wonderful night. And it was special to go back and relive a lot of that.
And the Tigers were in attendance.
Yeah.
I love when teams support each other
Absolutely.
Within the city.
That's great.
I love 100%. That.
Yeah, they had on the Jumbotron at Comerica Park, they had Fedorov 91 mm-hmm. on the board. And with the way the board is shaped now, it looks like a jersey because it's got the wings if you put it out like this. So it was very cool. I agree. Everybody's behind this here in the city of Detroit. All right, that's going to do it for us. Kevin Dietz and Altalk coming your way next here on WJR. Have a good day.